This is The Takeaway for Tuesday, May 23rd, 2017.
We were at the front right and the bang went, seemed to come from the back left, and then suddenly just heard screaming and everybody was running from the back towards the front. And it was just sheer chaos. People trying to get off the balconies. It was awful.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Noelle King from NPR's Planet Money, in for John Hockenberry today. Last night, an explosion tore through a foyer at Manchester Arena in England at the end of a concert by pop star Ariana Grande. At least 22 people were killed, some of them children. More than 50 people were injured.
I can confirm that the man suspected of carrying out last night's atrocity is 22-year-old Salman Abidi.
That's Manchester police identifying the suicide bomber. ISIS has taken responsibility for the attack. Authorities have also made an arrest in connection with the bombing.
It is the worst attack the city has experienced, and the worst ever to hit the north of England. The police and security services are working at speed to establish the complete picture.
Prime Minister Theresa May spoke today condemning the act. President Trump weighed in as well from his overseas trip.
I won't call them monsters because they would like that term. They would think that's a great name. I will call them from now on losers because that's what they are. They're losers. And we'll have more of them. But they're losers. Just remember that.
Sewell Chan is the international news editor for the New York Times in their London office.
These were teenagers, so many of them were probably fairly new to going out on their own. Many had parents who did not want to sit in the concert or did not have the time to sit in the concert with them, but were waiting outside ready to pick them up. So it was a very vulnerable moment. And I think one of the especially stunning things about this is how, you know, someone could have targeted victims so early in really not even in the prime of their lives yet, but really children.
British authorities, as you say, are calling this a terror attack. Do we know anything about the attacker?
What we know so far is that a man set off an improvised explosive device, which basically means a homemade bomb, in the entrance hall right outside the main arena. We're trying to find out exactly what security measures were taken, but it was kind of a transitional space between the main arena hall where the concert was taking place and the train station, which is next to the arena.
And how is the city of Manchester responding today? Did people go to work?
I think with incredible solidarity and grief. It's a very proud city, proud of its regional identity, proud of its working class traditions, its role in the Industrial Revolution, obviously proud of its football team, soccer team. I think there's a kind of resilient spirit. There were a lot of displays of generosity last night, hotels opening their doors to anyone who needed a place to stay, homeowners opening up their apartments, free cab rides. So the kinds of things you would expect. I think the country is still reeling. It's the worst terrorist attack in the UK since 2005. So understandably, people are deeply shaken.
How are British politicians responding at the national level? Prime Minister Theresa May spoke earlier. What did she have to say?
The Prime Minister announced that the law enforcement investigation, she'd announced the cowardice behind the attacks and said that even though it seems trite to say so, it's true that terrorism will not win. That was her message. And she went on to note that campaigning had been suspended and that she was traveling to Manchester to meet with local officials. Britain has a general election coming up in just a few weeks on June 8th. I think in general, most politicians right now are really focusing on trying to better understand what happened and expressing condolences and support. There's been no, as far as I've seen, no use of this for political or partisan messaging.
Are we seeing ripple effects out into the rest of the world in terms of other countries worried about security, other venues worried about security? What is the rest of Europe look like today?
Look, I think that's a question we're asking throughout the world right now. We all have seen beefed up security at museums, at airports, certainly, but even now at concert venues. There were bag checks at this arena. Where they were precisely and whether they could have stopped someone from infiltrating, again, this transitional space, that's going to be a big question. I think it's a giant question for open societies. How do we protect mass events where people are going to congregate, whether that's a sports event, a cultural event? Are people going to, you know, avoid these events and just focus on home-based entertainment? What kind of effect would that have on further producing an atomized and divided society? So I think it goes to profound questions of what it means to live in an open society. Certainly after the November 2015 attacks in Paris on the soccer stadium and on a concert hall in Paris, in addition to bars and restaurants, that conversation, I think, is only picking up speed now about how do we, you know, safeguard the very kinds of mundane daily activities that make life itself rich and fulfilling and interesting.
So some very big questions, and a lot remains to be seen. Sewell Chan is international news editor for The New York Times. He joined us from London. Sewell, thanks so much.
Thank you, Noel.
President Trump may be overseas, but the news cycle here at home continues to churn. Late yesterday, The Washington Post reported that last March, President Trump appealed to Daniel Coats, the director of National Intelligence, and Admiral Mike Rogers, the director of the National Security Agency. Trump allegedly asked the two intelligence officials to publicly deny the existence of evidence of collusion between his campaign and Russia during the 2016 election. Both men reportedly said no to the president's request. In congressional testimony today, Coates said,
"I don't feel it's appropriate to characterize discussions and conversations with the president."
Also yesterday, President Trump's former national security advisor, Michael Flynn, said he will not turn over Russia-related documents to a Senate committee investigating Russian interference in the election. Flynn said he'll plead the fifth and retain his right to not incriminate himself. There is a lot going on, and here to help us figure some of it out is Amy Sabrin. She's a retired partner from the law firm of Skadden Arps. She represented numerous public officials and executives in Department of Justice investigations. Amy, thanks for being with us.
I'm glad to be here. Hello, Noel.
So let's start with the first set of allegations, that the president tried to influence two top intelligence officials, asking them to deny evidence of collusion. If this is true, how big a deal is this legally?
It is not in itself. Those actions are not in themselves obstruction of justice, because those officials were not involved in the investigations and they were asked to make public statements about it. But it is highly relevant evidence to a charge of obstruction of justice, and of course fits a pattern if we are to believe the news accounts we've been seeing lately. My second reaction is that the president and his staff appear to be appallingly ignorant of how our government works. He seems totally unaware that the FBI is essentially an independent agency, or that intelligence agencies do not exist to do the political bidding of the president.
President Trump's conversation with Admiral Mike Rogers was documented in an internal memo written by a senior NSA official, which sounds very similar to memos kept and written by former FBI Director James Comey. Amy, is this usually how it's done, officials keeping memos on every conversation with a sitting president?
Well, there are extensive records kept of communications with sitting presidents by everyone he deals with. The FBI in particular is used to memorializing any conversations relating to any investigation. I don't know enough about the NSA to know how usual it is, but it's certainly highly unusual for a president to make such a request of intelligence officers, so I would understand why he might memorialize it.
All right, let's move over to Michael Flynn, President Trump's former national security advisor. I am going to start with a novice's question. Does invoking the Fifth Amendment mean that Mr. Flynn is guilty of something?
No. Any competent defense lawyer would advise her client to assert the Fifth in these circumstances. It does not mean you are guilty of something. It means that the witness's lawyer assesses, rightly in this case, I believe, that her client has potential exposure to criminal charges.
And if you were Mr. Flynn's lawyer, would you have advised him to take the Fifth?
Yes, I would. This is a legal long shot by the lawyer, in the sense that the argument that his Fifth Amendment rights preclude him from providing documents is almost without any support in the law. But he is playing a long game here. He realizes that it is very cumbersome and time-consuming for the Senate to enforce a subpoena like this, and he's hoping that they may, rather than take that circuitous route, short-circuit it and grant him immunity.
Are you saying that it is unusual for someone to take the Fifth Amendment with respect to documents versus testimony?
Yes. The basic law on that issue is that there is no Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination for things you wrote down in documents or that others wrote down in documents, you know, and sent to you. That you have in your possession. There are very limited circumstances, which I don't want to bore your audience with explaining, where that there is an exception to that rule. But the basic rule is that documents that were written prior in time do not enjoy Fifth Amendment protection.
Do we know anything about the documents that Mr. Flynn is refusing to turn over?
Well, we know what the subpoena requested, and I've reviewed the request. It's pretty basic. It's communications relating to Russia during certain time periods, or to and from Russians during certain time periods. It's a pretty basic request. They've also asked him to make a list of all the contacts that he had with Russians, and that would be, in my view, protected by the Fifth Amendment, because that, in essence, is creating a document that's a form of testimony.
How might Congress respond? Could he be held in contempt of Congress, or is that unlikely?
There are three ways Congress can enforce a subpoena. The typical way is to for the Senate to pursue civil enforcement, seek to hold him in civil contempt. That requires the majority of the committee and then the majority of the Senate to vote to hold him in contempt, as I said. And then it is referred to a court to enforce. And then when he gets into court, he could raise these arguments again about his Fifth Amendment rights. And there would be litigation about that. There could be appeals. So you can see it's a time-consuming process.
What does this mean for Robert Mueller, who's overseeing the collusion investigation?
If they were to grant Flynn immunity, it would make it nearly impossible to prosecute him, especially if the immunity somehow extended to his documents. Because once the Senate committee grants immunity and Flynn testifies and produces those documents, Mr. Mueller would be precluded from using any of that evidence against him, as well as any evidence derived from that. So if the documents provided leads and so forth.
All right. So what happens next?
Well, I think the committee, I know that some of them have talked about seeking contempt against Mr. Flynn. I think they're going to realize that's a long, drawn-out process. They may start that process. I think it's also important to point out that this committee doesn't have any special investigatory staff. They, unless they've hired them in the last several days, they didn't have litigators and so forth to do this. So they could go down that road. In the meantime, there are plenty of other avenues for them to seek information relevant to Mr. Flynn and Russia and potential collusion. They could, for example, subpoena documents related to Mr. Flynn and the Russians from the campaign, from the White House, from his businesses, none of which would have a Fifth Amendment privilege. They could interview numerous other witnesses. There are other people in the White House that might have knowledge of these events.
Okay, so a lot of options still left on the table. Amy Sabrin is a retired partner from the law firm Skadden Arps. Amy, thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
President Trump is in Israel again today. In his first trip abroad as president, Trump has focused on a couple big themes: strengthening ties between allies, creating stability, confronting extremism, and isolating Iran.
Most importantly, the United States and Israel can declare with one voice that Iran must never be allowed to possess a nuclear weapon, never, ever, and must cease its deadly funding, training, and equipping of terrorists and militias. And it must cease immediately. There is a growing realization among your Arab neighbors that they have common cause with you and the threat posed by Iran. And it is indeed a threat. There's no question about that.
That was the president on Monday speaking at a joint press conference with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. And here's the president on Sunday in Saudi Arabia.
No discussion of stamping out this threat would be complete without mentioning the government that gives terrorists all three: safe harbor, financial backing, and the social standing needed for recruitment. It is a regime that is responsible for so much instability in that region. I am speaking, of course, of Iran.
All right. So how does Iran see all of this? Joining us now is Naheed Siamdoust. She's a lecturer at Yale's Macmillan Center. She's also author of Soundtrack of the Revolution, The Politics of Music in Iran. Naheed, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
All right. So what do you think about all of this anti-Iran rhetoric? Is this just kind of what we'd expect, given that President Trump is in Saudi Arabia and now Israel, no great friends of Iran?
No, this is a real shift away from Obama's Middle East policy. So President Obama, during his term, he, as we know, achieved the Iran nuclear deal with Iran and really tried to bring Iran into the fold to rebalance the security situation in the Middle East by giving Iran a greater role. In his interview, one of his last interviews with The Atlantic, for example, he talked about Saudi Arabia and other countries in the region needing to share the neighborhood and have a sort of cold peace and really come to terms with one another. President Trump, however, he really campaigned on a very anti-Iran rhetoric before the elections. And since taking office, although he's extended the nuclear deal with Iran, saying that they have abided by the terms of the agreement, in Saudi Arabia and Israel has been vociferously against Iran. And that's not surprising. For all of those parties, for Iran, Israel, and Saudi Arabia, Iran is a very convenient enemy. Of course, Iran does play its own power politics in the region. And Iran and Saudi Arabia have not been friends since Iran's revolution in 1979, because Khomeini was a revolutionary and anti-colonial revolutionary who was against the kind of deep relationship, deep monetary relationship that Saudi Arabia had with the United States. And of course, it was opposed to Israel for taking over Palestinian lands and so on. But currently now, with President Trump in office, of course, for Saudi Arabia, this means that it can ignore the kinds of problems that it has at home, its own repression of its citizens, the lack of democracy there. For Israel, of course, focus on Iran is a convenient way of ignoring the 70-year problem of not having any kind of agreement with the Palestinians. And for President Trump, currently, one could argue that it is also a great distraction away from his own problems at home.
You know, Iran's newly reelected president had an interesting take on all of this. He was talking about Saudi citizens yesterday, and President Rouhani said, and I'm paraphrasing a little, those poor people have never seen a ballot box. Now, that's obviously a nod to recent elections in Iran, which ushered in a host of reformist and moderate candidates. What do you think about that? I mean, is he digging back a little at Saudi Arabia and the U.S.?
I mean, sure he is. And it's not a very surprising position for him to take. Iran has been a fairly cohesive national unit for 3,000 years. And they called for a constitution, for example, in 1906, before many Europeans did. So there has been a lot of political activity and participation with political life within Iran for at least a century, whereas Saudi Arabia, of course, does not even have a constitution. Its constitution is the Quran and the hadith of the traditions of the prophet. And it has never had any elections. It is an absolute monarchy. So for Trump to be speaking of repression, as Iran's foreign minister Javad Zarif tweeted soon after Trump's speech, he said, I forget verbatim, but he said something like, well, this is ironic coming from the president being in the bastion of moderation and democracy, something like that, speaking from Saudi Arabia. So for the Iranians, this is, of course, really disappointing, because they did just partake in great numbers in an election to bring in a moderate. Granted, the elections are not super free and fair. The candidates have been vetted by the Guardian Council, but still, Iranians went out en masse and 57% voted to bring back the reformist Rouhani, who has promised an opening to the world, relations with the world, moderation, peace, all these things that President Trump says the U.S. and his allies, or the U.S. allies in the Middle East, should be looking to. Well, that's what the Iranians have called for. So to completely ignore the wish of the Iranian people in bringing back Rouhani and speak of Iran as if it was this place that was vastly worse in terms of democracy and freedom of speech and all of that than a place like Saudi Arabia, where there's no constitution, is, of course, kind of ridiculous.
What do ordinary Iranians think of President Trump?
Well, I think they think along similar lines as Americans, for the most part. He doesn't have many friends or any friends, I would think, in Iran. The majority of Iranians want to have better relations with the world. It's a vastly young country. It's the Middle East's second largest population. They're very well educated. Women are the majority of students in universities. In fact, it's a very equal society in terms of education and opportunities and so on. Not so much in terms of political and job opportunities. There, women are still lagging behind. But it's a very open society with a lot of access to the internet, satellite television. They're really well-versed in what's happening in the world and really well engaged. So they were not happy that Trump was elected because they could see that that would bring an end to the kind of opening that President Obama created for Iran.
Do you think all of this anti-Iran rhetoric remains rhetoric? I mean, politicians, world leaders talk all of the time. They slam each other all of the time. Is that where it's going to stay?
For the most part, we all hope this is just rhetoric and this is just Trump going around and, you know, he's not a man of principle. He said things before that are 180 degrees different from what he says now about Saudi Arabia and other places in the Middle East. So one would hope that this won't devolve into disaster in the Middle East.
Naheed Siamdoust is a lecturer at Yale's Macmillan Center. She's also author of Soundtrack of the Revolution, The Politics of Music in Iran. Thank you for coming in, Naheed.
Thank you.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Noel King, in for John Hockenberry. Since an earthquake devastated Haiti in 2010, around 58,000 Haitians have been living in the U.S. under something called Temporary Protected Status, or TPS. This is a program for citizens of countries that are dealing with serious conflicts or natural disasters. The protection for these folks was set to expire in July, but the Department of Homeland Security said yesterday they will extend TPS for another 6 months to allow time for Haitians living here to get their affairs in order. Immigration advocates had lobbied hard for the extension, saying even 7 years after the earthquake, the country is still not stable enough for Haitians to return home.
It was a pretty dense situation because I had to run for my life.
Kenneth Azzi is a Haitian citizen who's in the U.S. under TPS. He lives in the Boston area and is just finishing up his third year at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. He moved to the U.S. just a couple days after the earthquake in 2010.
I consider it as a miracle, the fact that I was able to make it. I had to travel to Dominican Republic, from Dominican Republic, travel to New York in order for me to be here and to have a better life.
How old were you when the earthquake happened?
I was 19.
19?
19-year-old.
All right, you're about to enter your final year of college. Are you working as well?
Yes, I am a retirement specialist. I also do investments, and I do learning and development for the company.
Back in April, the acting director of U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, a man named James McCammon, said TPS for Haitians should not be extended again because he says conditions in that country have improved enough for you and others like you to go back. What are you hearing from your friends and family back home? Have things improved enough so that if you were to get on a plane in 6 months, you could get on with your life?
Well, if I can give you a short timeline of the situation of Haiti. So in 2010, there was this huge earthquake that completely destroyed the country. After that earthquake, there was a huge cholera epidemic killing thousands of people. The third was the recent Category 4 hurricane that devastated most part of the country. So considering everything that took place within the past 7 years, I can confidently say I'm adamant about it that Haiti is not ready to receive 50,000 people.
And when you say Haiti is not ready to have you back, can you tell me specifically what it is you're talking about? I mean, on a very basic level, how are your parents doing?
I am fortunate that my family is doing okay. It's not doing the best because of condition of life. But when it comes to other families, it will not be the same for them because we have a lot of children. 5, 6, or 10-year-old, they do not have access to clean water. They do not have access to safety. Safety is actually one of the most important aspects. People, they cannot eat. They cannot provide to their family, so they have to go out of their way in order to survive. There's a lot more that we can say, there's a lot more, but in summary, that is some of the factors creating instability and making Haiti not a safe place as of right now.
You know, Kenny, a lot of people would say that the key word in temporary protected status is temporary. You've been in the U.S. for 7 years. You've done very well for yourself. But how long do you think that this program should continue to cover you?
I will honestly say 18 to 24 months.
18 to 24 months.
That is correct. Just to allow things to get back on track, even though the Haitian government on its own, they will not be able to do everything in 18 to 24 months, but that will psychologically prepare people and having them allocate enough resources to get back to Haiti.
All right. Kenny Azzi, thank you so much for being with us.
No, thank you for having me.
Kenny Azzi is a Haitian living under temporary protected status in the U.S. President Trump may be traveling overseas, but nevertheless, he releases today a $4.1 trillion budget for 2018. The proposed budget, and remember, it is just a proposed budget so far, includes hikes for the military, cuts to foreign aid, but perhaps most significantly, massive cuts to domestic spending. That is not what he promised voters on the campaign trail.
Save Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security without cuts. Have to do it. Get rid of the fraud, get rid of the waste and abuse, but save it.
That is then-candidate Trump in June of 2015. In the proposed budget out today, we expect entitlements to take a $1.7 trillion hit over the next 10 years. To get there, cuts would be made to SNAP, or food stamps, Social Security Disability Insurance, and Medicaid, among other programs. The budget, of course, will need to get through Congress before any of these proposals becomes reality. Jonathan Cohn is senior national correspondent at HuffPost, where he covers healthcare, social welfare, and politics.
Of course, we all know President Trump has said he wants to repeal the Affordable Care Act, and he has endorsed the bill that's moving through Congress right now, which by itself would be a huge cut to healthcare programs. What's remarkable about this budget is that it takes those cuts, the bulk of which are, so many of which are into the Medicaid program, and then it adds more cuts. They want to go beyond what that bill would do, and they want to cut the Medicaid program even further. They also want to cut the Children's Health Insurance Program, which is a program that dates back to the 90s, with a bipartisan program, and that has responsible for giving health insurance to millions of children.
There are also cuts to SNAP or food stamps. There are cuts to the Social Security Disability Insurance Program. If this budget is sending us a message, what is that message?
On the one hand, here they are. They are cutting programs, as I said, for children that give children health insurance. They are cutting programs that help people, families, mostly working families, put food on their tables. They are cutting programs that provide disability payments to workers who have been injured on the job. And they are cutting Medicaid, which people forget, a lot of the money in Medicaid goes to the disabled and to the elderly. So they are really cutting programs that are not just helpful, but really a lifeline to some of the most vulnerable members of our society, the old, the disabled, the sick, children. We are taking a huge amount of money out of those programs. And where is that money going? Well, on the other side of the budget, they are calling for these massive tax cuts that will, you know, overwhelmingly benefit the wealthiest people in America. So this is literally taking money from the people who desperately need it just to get food on their plates, just to pay for their medical care, you know, nursing homes, very basic needs. And meanwhile, giving huge tax breaks to the people, that narrow, tiny slice of America that has managed to thrive in a frequently struggling economy, the people who are best off and need the money least.
It was financially strapped people. It was people struggling economically who helped elect President Trump. How do you think this is going to play to his base?
You know, it is an interesting question how they will react. You know, Trump as a candidate, you know, he promised not to be a typical Republican, right? I mean, he would frequently say, I'm not going to cut Medicaid. I'm not that kind of Republican. And, you know, he would say things like, we need to cover everybody with health insurance. Well, clearly now they are going back on that promise. you know, the question is, will his supporters realize it in now, or is something like this going to go through? Are some of these cuts going to become law, and then they will feel it, you know, a year from now, 2 years from now, 5 years from now? And I don't know the answer to that. That's a political question. But there's no question at all that he has broken a promise to his supporters to protect them when he, you know, sorts out his priorities.
Jonathan Cohn is senior national correspondent at HuffPost, where he covers healthcare, social welfare, and politics. Jonathan, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me on the show.
One of the fundamental rights of people caught up in our criminal justice system is due process. That means you get a competent attorney, and if you lose the case, you get to appeal. We're going to talk today about a case in Tennessee that illustrates some of the difficulties with that state's appeals process. In 2007, a man named Thomas Edward Clardy was convicted of murder and sentenced to life for killing a man and wounding a woman at an auto body shop in Madison, Tennessee. Clardy has always insisted that he's innocent. His wife provided an alibi, and when he lost the case, he appealed. Now, in Tennessee, there's a limit to how much an appointed attorney can earn defending a client who's appealing a conviction. That means lawyers representing clients on appeal, like Thomas Edward Clardy, often earn next to nothing for their work. Andrew Cohen is a senior editor at the Marshall Project. He's been covering Clardy's case. Jessica Van Dyke is an attorney at Parker Lawrence Law in Nashville, Tennessee. She represents Clardy. And she says this case started with a lot of confusion, including conflicting reports from eyewitnesses.
At the hospital, the victims were both interviewed. They were giving descriptions. They were talking about the car being a four-door, dark-colored car. They were giving heights and weights and head coverings. And so still to this day, it's unclear to me how Mr. Clardy became the suspect, other than he was in the same neighborhood. And the connection that has been stated is that he had the nickname T, the letter T. And that was what police used to get Mr. Clardy in their sights.
The brother of the victim who survived offered a physical description of the perpetrator. He identified a tattoo. He said the perpetrator had gold teeth. Mr. Clardy has neither of those things. How significant is that?
Well, we think it's hugely significant. And that's been our argument since we got back ballistics testing in this case, because the reality is that there were shell casings all over this garage. They were collected, as they typically are, by police. But for reasons that are unknown to this day, they were never actually tested. They were entered into the system in a format that allowed them to never be matched up to other crimes that occurred. So when ballistics were tested in January of 2016, we received two hits to two other crimes that happened after this homicide, but prior to Mr. Clardy's trial.
Andrew Cohen of the Marshall Project, I want to turn this over to you. We have a very complicated case. We have a man whose lawyer doesn't seem to have done perhaps the best job she could for him. We have conflicting testimonies. This, to me, seems like the kind of thing that could happen in any town, in any city, in any state in the country. You, however, are very focused on this being a Tennessee story. Why is that?
The problem, I think, is made measurably worse in Tennessee because of the rules that Tennessee has set up to try to rectify these sorts of cases, to try to identify wrongful convictions, to try to generate exonerations when they're appropriate. The whole structure of the appellate process, it seems to me, is to put lawyers in the best position they can be to find errors that occur at trial, errors that are material enough to have made a difference in the outcome of the case. If you pay post-conviction attorneys a fair rate, if you allow them to do the investigative work that they say that they need to do, that they can justify, if you don't cap out their expenses or their fees to $1,000 or in some cases $2,000, you're going to get attorneys who have an economic and a financial incentive to dig at the truth, to get to the bottom of things. And if you do that, you're going to have better arguments. You're going to have more serious arguments. You're going to have more cases where wrongful convictions are identified and then rectified. Tennessee doesn't do any of that. In fact, it does such a poor job of ensuring due process and fair appellate rights based on this fee structure that the Tennessee Supreme Court itself basically said, we have to change things. There has to be a change here to the way that attorneys, post-conviction attorneys, are paid. There has to be some way that we can make this system more fair by incentivizing attorneys to get involved in the cases, to get better attorneys involved in the cases, so that we can have results that everyone can be comfortable with. And I think that's why I thought this case was suitable for case in point.
Andrew, there's one part of this that I found particularly confusing. The lawyers that are representing a defendant like Mr. Clardy on appeal, are they being assigned to the accused or are the convicted in this case? Or is the individual who's convicted going out and finding that attorney and then hiring them?
It can be either way. If you're fortunate enough to have the money to pay for your own attorney, you can do so. And in fact, initially, Mr. Clardy did pay for his attorney. The trial attorney he had was retained counsel. Most people in Mr. Clardy's situation can't pay for an attorney, and so they have one provided for them. They can have a public defender provided for them, in which case they probably are lucky because some of the public defender systems in Tennessee are better than some of the others. Or they can have a private attorney appointed, in which case it's basically catch as catch can. And that, I think, also is something that Tennessee says it wants to work on, wants to sort of fix the safety net that exists.
And Jessica, this means that as the lawyer representing Mr. Clardy on appeal, there is a limit to how much money you can make?
Yes. The way that I put it in terms of for my non-attorney friends is I say I basically have to recreate the Serial podcast for $1,000.
Wow.
And you can file a motion asking for extended and complex, and they can give you up to $2,000. Most of the time, post-conviction attorneys are going to be appointed by the state of Tennessee. So I was actually the fourth or fifth appointed attorney on this case. And it puts you at odds with the client sometimes because the client wants you to do 25 different tasks, and you're looking at, gosh, you know, I've got to pay these bills, and I really want to give the person the best defense possible. The situation for a lot of attorneys that are asked to not only review complex cases, but you really have to recreate and retry the case if you want to meet the legal standards for getting someone a new trial.
Where does Mr. Clardy's case stand now?
So he recently was denied a new trial at the trial level, and we will be appealing that to the Tennessee Court of Criminal Appeals.
So you're going to continue working for him?
Absolutely.
Jessica Van Dyke is an attorney at Parker Lawrence Law in Nashville, Tennessee. Thank you, Jessica.
Thank you.
And Andrew Cohen is a senior editor at The Marshall Project. Andrew, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
The Takeaway is supported by Bluevine, offering businesses revolving lines of credit to help them grow and to expand. Credit lines up to $100,000. Small business credit help is available at bluevine.com. And Lumosity, brain training developed by scientists and game designers who turned cognitive research tasks into games to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at lumosity.com.
It is college graduation season, a time of celebration and optimism, and also a lot of anxiety. I was definitely more the anxious type. And so, for guidance and inspiration, many colleges turn to commencement speakers.
No matter where you wind up, you can create a thriving community of your own if you're willing to put in the same kind of energy and effort that you invested here at Virginia Tech.
Making a difference has its own rich reward.
Learning is all about taking chances and rolling up your sleeves and working hard. Now, sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. But one thing is for sure, if you never try, you're never going to win.
Class of 2017. And I will always love you.
Presidents and poets and entrepreneurs and comedians, the speakers these days are often the most anticipated part of the graduation ceremony. So, meet Christina Nagrut.
Growing up in Romania, I didn't even know what the commencement speech is.
For nearly a decade, she's been collecting commencement speeches on her website, Graduation Wisdom, the best commencement speeches and quotes.
I would have never guessed that I would make it my mission to dispel the idea that all graduation speeches are boring. I found out there are two aspects. First of all, for the best speeches, the speaker has to be good at introspection to really take the time to look back at their lives.
The three lessons that have had the greatest impact on my life have to do with feelings, with failure, and with finding happiness.
And
so you want a roadmap, is what you're saying.
Yes,
how'd you get up there?
Yeah. But then the most important thing is to use stories to illustrate the advice that they want to share.
So here I am, 22, making $22,000 a year, and yet it didn't feel right. The news director said to me at the time, nobody's going to remember Oprah, so we want to change your name. We've come up with a name we think that people will remember and people will like. It's a friendly name. Susie.
You see, there's a really fine line. It's really easy to end up with a list of platitudes and cliches like, you know, big dream and follow your heart. And those are just not resonating with the audience. Human beings have this capacity of responding emotionally to stories. So this emotional response is what makes our brains commit the information to long-term memory. So we end up with memorable speeches.
You collect commencement speeches. Give me a couple of speeches that really stand out to you, some of your favorites.
One of the first one I read even before I started the website is by Steve Jobs, who I guess doesn't need an introduction. It was given at Stanford University in 2005.
I had a scan at 7:30 in the morning, and it clearly showed a tumor on my pancreas.
He talks about the time when he was first diagnosed with pancreatic cancer and the terrifying day when he was waiting for the results of his biopsy.
My doctor advised me to go home and get my affairs in order, which is doctor's code for prepare to die.
The fact that we are all going to die is, in his opinion, the main tool to avoid, you know, the trap of thinking that we have something to lose.
You are already naked. There is no reason not to follow your heart.
And, you know, to follow our courage to pursue our passions.
What could have been cliched, follow your dreams, trust yourself, turns into something quite different when the speaker says, you're all going to die someday.
Yeah.
Another one of your favorites came from Jennifer Lee at the University of New Hampshire in 2014. Now, this is not a speech that I know, but Jennifer Lee was the woman who wrote Frozen, which is a movie I have watched with my niece at least 700 times. Mm-hmm. What did she have to say?
I really love this speech because she really opens up again with personal narrative.
I was as graceful as a pile of pickup sticks. My hair was perpetually knotted, stains on the clothes. I was basically a target for bullies. And I was bullied severely for years.
She uses a nice metaphor. She was wearing the nasty lenses of self-doubt.
And, you know, people talk about the dangers of the rose-colored glasses, but let me tell you, the lenses of self-doubt are far worse. They're, like, nasty and thick and big and filthy, and they're covered in swamp scum, and there's, like, a family of snails living on them, and it's, like, impossible to see past them.
How do you think social media has changed commencement speeches? I mean, you've been watching them since before the days of everything being Twitterable in, you know, a split second after it's said.
Nowadays, of course, there's way more pressure on the speaker because of social media and sharing the information around the globe, essentially. But what I say is that with great pressure comes great opportunity, because the speeches, even by not so well-known speakers, can go viral.
So wake up, lift your voices until you've patched every hole in a child's broken sky. Wake up every child so they know of their celestial potential. I've been the black hole in a classroom for far too long, absorbing everything without allowing my light to escape. But those days are done. I belong among the stars, and so do you.
So it's very nice. It's a great opportunity because you can share the advice, not just with the graduates, but with a lot more people.
We're living in a country that is increasingly politically divided, or at the very least, it feels that way. Do you think that the political climate might contribute to a change in the kinds of speakers that universities are booking or in the kind of speeches that are being given?
Because of the current socio-political environment we have today, I think we're going to see more people paying attention to high-profile Democrats giving speeches this year, which it might not have happened in the past. So, you know, it's Hillary Clinton at Wellesley College, Bernie Sanders, Senator Joe Biden, Senator Cory Booker. So people will pay attention to what they say. And then I think speakers will face more apprehension on whether they should address the current environment. And I think quite a few of them will emphasize the importance of not taking our democratic institutions for granted. Anna Quindlen, in her speech this year at Washington University in St. Louis, she says that it's very difficult to craft a commencement speech, even in a year when the country does not seem to be going through a nervous breakdown. So I love that.
Christina Negroot has been collecting commencement speeches for almost a decade. You can find her favorites on her website, Graduation Wisdom, the best commencement speeches and quotes. Christina, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Here's my advice for the class of 2017. Seek wisdom beyond learning.
Be brave and take risks. Be kind and always do the right thing. And start saving money right now.
You still have work to do, a road to pave, and a world to make into a future for you and others.
Humility will shield you from all criticism. Nothing can disarm good humor and laughter.
Start or join humanitarian causes and speak up for the powerless.
Ready, set, begin.
Give us your take at 8778MYTAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. You can find me on Twitter. I'm at Noelle King. I'm Noelle King in for John Hockenberry. It's been great being with you these last 2 days. Thank you for listening. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.